You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 10th, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, good evening.
And special guest rogue this week is Brian Dunning from Skeptoid.
You don't have to take drugs to be cool. Bad Albert, the old friend.
Buy the pudding pop.
So, Brian, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you, thank you.
We've had you on before, but today you're going to be a guest rogue for the whole show.
Long-time listener, first-time rogue.
Before we chat, Evan, tell us what the special skeptical day of today is.
Yes, on February 10th, 1667, classic paleontological paper by Nicholas Steno, S-T-E-N-O,
Inventor
was published
stenograph.
By the Royal Society, London. His topic was Head of a Shark Dissected, and it represented the first such scientific paper to recognize that fossils were the remains of creatures who had died and subsequently had become petrified. Huh. And this was a big controversy at the time.
Yeah, paleontology really took off once they realized that fossils were like dead creatures. That was a big breakthrough.
What did they think they were?
1667.
Yeah, what did they think that head-like protuberance was?
Interestingly, yeah. They thought...
Old artwork?
They thought that they were natural geological formations.
They were stupid.
And...
Well, no, they were just very skeptical. You know, these days we have to tell people that burnt toast isn't the Virgin Mary. But these people, they took it so far. They're like, these heads. No, you just think they're heads. They look like heads.
But they thought that biological forms were some intrinsic property of nature and that they could manifest in rock as well as in life.
And that they were
everywhere.
They
weren't that skeptical then.
Right. No, yeah. So this is pre-evolutionary, where they thought that this information, these designs, were in nature and they were just manifesting themselves.
So they never saw a rotted corpse before?
But
good
well,
question.
Not made out of rock.
Oh, petrified right. ones, yeah.
Yeah, well,
yes,
okay.
Wow, that's really interesting. I didn't know that.
Well, and of course, the other big date this week is February 12th, Darwin Day.
Darwin Day, Lincoln Day.
Hello, Darwin Day. It's a growing phenomenon the world round.
I think you mean world oblate spheroid.
Yes,
no,
that's right.
That's
oh, my God. Really, guys?
Is that what this has come to?
Happy Darwin Day.
Happy Darwin Day, everybody.
What about Valentine's Day?
Yep. Screw Valentine's Day. Darwin Day.
Yeah, Valentine's Day is a fake corporate holiday to get you to buy stuff.
Yeah, and that argument goes over real well at home.
Yeah. let's change it this year. Let's just say I love Darwin Day and mix the two holidays.
Well, yeah, that's what we do on Skeptic pretty much every year. We had Darwin pickup lines, and then we had Darwin Valentine's Day cards. So, yeah.
I'll give Lisa a copy of my Ray Comfort book for a present.
What girl wouldn't love that? Lisa,
yeah.
For starters.
And she's throwing it back at you.
Brian, how's Skeptoid doing?
Skeptoid is rocking and rolling. As many of your listeners may have heard, I decided to bring out a video version of it. It's called In Fact. I want to be clear that the In Fact videos are not intended to be, you know, in addition to Skeptoid. They are based on Skeptoid episodes. I've actually caught a lot of flack for that. People have watched them and said, but this was already one of your Skeptoid episodes. It's like, yeah, that's the idea. I'm trying to take the most popular of the Skeptoid episodes and repackage them in a much shorter format for basically the YouTube audience, the online video audience, which is much, much, much larger than the podcast audience. So, you know, trying to, you know, not only on the one hand give existing skeptics who listen to podcasts, give them an existing tool, something that they can, you know, show to other people, give to their schools, whatever they want to do, but also reach a whole new broader audience. And if you want to check that out, it's at infactvideo.com. And you go there and you get links to all your favorite video sharing websites. It's available as a podcast for iTunes or for Zune, and it's on all of the major video sharing websites, YouTube, Vimeo, Meta Cafe, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a lot of fun to do, but I tell you, they're not kidding. People who do video, it is an order of magnitude more work than doing audio.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yep. Yeah.
So, oh, my God. At least
our few forays into video have been, yeah.
Well, I did see one of them over the summer. I guess it was probably the first one that you made. And I was really impressed. The production value
was really good.
Was extremely high. I liked the format of the content, and I thought you looked very handsome. So,
thank you.
Yeah, they got your good side. Yeah,
the backside. Yeah, facing away from the camera.
Oh.
And what's the other project you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, the referencing project. Now, this is something that I just hope might be of interest to people who are involved in any kind of research or who might see an application to do something. To do something similar. But it goes back to sort of a weakness. When I first started doing the Skeptoid podcast, you know, I was new to this. I didn't really know what I was doing. I didn't know what the future was going to bring. And I didn't happen to keep notes on all the references that I used. You know, once I finished an episode, I, you know, deleted that folder off my computer and moved on to the next one.
Delete?
So then, yeah. You know, I think in those days, hard drives were like 40 megs.
Okay.
So I was talking to Joe Nickel, who is, you know, a hell of a nice guy and will bend over backwards to help you out any way he can. And he had sent, I had sent him a couple of the Skeptoid books, which are basically compilations. They're adapted from the Skeptoid episodes, each chapter of the book. And he'd looked at them and said, you know, these are great, but, and then he basically grabbed me by the scruff of the collar and shoved me against the wall and shook me and said, you need to put references in all of these chapters. I'm like, oh, I don't have them. That's hundreds of chapters. He was talking about 150 chapters by then, and there was no references on any of them.
Ooh.
Now, with everything else that I'm doing, I simply don't have the time to go back and look up authoritative references. You know, I want to have at least 5, 6, or 8 of them for each one of these chapters. So I opened up this project to volunteers. And inside the administrative section of the Skeptoid.com website, you know, where the people go who moderate comments and do things like that, there's a place for people to select chapters and start adding references. Mm-hmm. And it's in such a way that they don't have to enter them in bibliographic format. It does that automatically. And then every reference has to be seconded by two other people. So they have to look it up and verify that it's good. And they can also put comments on it if they don't like it. They can, you know, edit it if there's mistakes or whatever. And so just over a period of, I guess it's been going about 3 months now, we've got that almost all the way done. It's
a
huge amount of work. There's about 40 people who have been working on it. And I'm just really amazed at the power of a collaborative tool like this. And I'm really eager to see if there's anything else that that we could do with something like this.
Well, I'll give you an idea, because I agree with you that referencing takes a lot of work. There are often times where I'll write an article, and it takes me longer to reference it than to write it. To really find the optimal references that make the exact points that I want to make and back them up. Just hunting them down takes a long time. So one project I would love to do at some point, but I've started in fits and starts but never really put it together, is a comprehensive skeptical reference database. You want to find that reference that establishes that thing that skeptics always say, you know, like whatever that is, there's no correlation between the full moon and ER visits. Where's that reference? Just put that all together in one location. I think that would be a tremendous resource. And this, it sounds like this technology, whatever this software would be a good application. This is definitely, it's like the perfect wiki application. You know, where you need.
I was going to say, it sounds a little like skeptic wiki.
Yeah, you need 100 people working on it. It's too much for any one person to do.
It's going to make the web transcripts and the Skeptoid books, they're going to have a lot more legitimacy now as being, you know, real reputable sources.
Although by now you've learned to keep the folder, right?
Yes.
Thank you. Just making sure you've learned.
I do keep the folder.
Darn it.
In many cases.
Well, let's get on to a few news items. Actually, Brian, you're going to talk to us about Enceladus. There's a bit of an update on the question of whether or not there's actually any water under there.
Me again? Is this why you had me on the show, just so I could basically do the whole thing for you?
Yeah,
well, you're making your listeners do all the work for you. We're not going to call 100 people on to do it. We just have you.
Okay, there has been some new information about water on Enceladus. And Enceladus, as you may or may not know, is the sixth largest moon of Saturn. Now, it's one of these ice these ice moons. The surface of it has always been made of water ice. We've always known that. That's not a surprise. And it does have an atmosphere, but it's a very thin, very trace atmosphere. And that's almost all water vapor. Now it's not quite like Europa. It's Enceladus is water about a third of the way down, and then the core, the inner two thirds of the would that be the radius? I guess is mostly silicate and iron. So it's denser than it would be if it was just completely solid ice, which was actually the hypothesis for a while. So what this new information is that's now come out has made this more interesting. It's not really a case of, wow, here's some great new exciting discovery that's just been made, but it's you know, as the way so many of these things go, you learn a little bit and a little bit, and it's not very interesting yet, but then finally it gets to a point where, taken all together, it becomes very interesting. And I think that's where this new information has taken us. So the history of what we've learned about Enceladus goes back to about January of 2005, when Cassini first, the probe, the deep space probe Cassini, detected jets coming up from Enceladus, you know, just kind of optically detected these little pictures of these big geysers coming up from the surface. And they're coming from these cracks that we're able to determine with the infrared that they are about 100 degrees hotter than the surrounding ice. So we know that something warm is coming up through these jets. Now, at the same time, in the same flyby, they had a magnetometer on board, and it detected ion cyclotron waves. And without bothering to go into what that is, basically it means that the magnetic field of Enceladus is interacting with some ionized particles. So probably whatever's in these jets is some ionized particles. But, you know, we didn't have any proof to put two and two together or really know what that meant yet. Then in July of 2005, Cassini actually flew through one of these plumes and collected vapor directly and analyzed it with its ion and neutral mass spectrometer and found that it was almost all water. And so that confirmed that these jets were almost all water. And then in 2008, which is when we got this new data, it did another flyby. We got really good views of these plumes, really good photographs, and we measured the speed of these geysers coming up out of the surface. What do you think that was? It's like...
Fast.
Hypersonic.
2,000 kilometers an hour.
Wow.
So these are some fast geysers.
Hang on, kilometers. Right, okay. So sorry, this, us in the United
This information States. Has only now been published, and it comes from an instrument on board called CAPS, which is the Cassini Plasma Spectrometer. And it is that these water molecules in the atmosphere include negative ions. Mm-hmm. And you might say, well, okay, but that's kind of already what we knew. But this is the first time we've actually detected that, yes, these water molecules are actually the ionized particles that we were detecting. So it kind of it gives us a complete picture. Now, as you might be saying, as we know from these, you know, Kangen water filters, these magical water filters that claim to ionize and alkalize your water. Pure water can't really be ionized, at least to any meaningful degree. So it's got to have impurities in it. And so what happened with the CAPS instrument is we were able to see what these impurities were. They're basically salts and ionized hydrocarbons. And now, to put that into context, the quote from Dr. Andrew Coates at the University of College London says, "While it's no surprise that there's water there, these short-lived ions are extra evidence for subsurface water, and where there's water, carbon, and energy, some of the major ingredients for life are present."
That's why we're interested in this, yeah.
That's what makes it the big news, is because Now we have all the pieces to be able to make a statement like that.
Right. The carbon is an extra bit, but also I think my understanding was too that this adds to the interpretation of the fact that there's water plumes coming out of Enceladus, that it's coming from deep from Enceladus. It's not just a superficial pocket of melted water that's then spurting out, which would mean nothing. It means that there's probably deep subsurface water, you know, where there's also minerals.
Exactly.
It supports that interpretation, which is what we want, what would need to be present for there to be a probability of there actually being some life under there.
Because what's typical for these type of chemical concentrations, the salt water and the hydrocarbons, is a large pocket of water, either a whole undersea ocean or even a very large cavern. But they're heated. They're heated by either the tidal forces, the gravitational kneading of the planet, and or in the case of Enceladus, especially, they're heated by radioactive breakdown from the core of the planet. So right. We do have the energy source down there.
Guys,
so this
could you imagine
one step closer?
How profound would it be if there were bacterial life forms there?
Anything that we can call life.
Beyond profound.
We got to go there.
We do.
Yeah.
After Australia, maybe.
yeah, maybe.
Well, astronauts won't be getting there anytime soon. That's for damn sure.
We don't need to send people.
It's got to be robot. Yeah. We're gonna have to send robots.
Yeah.
Or if Bob had his way, we'd send embryos.
That could work.
The one thing I don't know is
go get them embryos.
Would it be easier to drill down through the ice on Enceladus or on Europa?
Right.
Yeah. That's the key right there.
But from what I understand, we don't really have the technology to drill so far down, either in Europa.
No, it wouldn't be drilling. It would be melting. It would basically be sitting on the surface and melting your way down. And the gravity is pretty darn low on Enceladus.
Right, right. Killing everything along the way. We're not sure how we would do it. Is the bottom line.
Yeah, right? No kidding.
So it's not just a matter of sending up existing techniques or technology. We really have to figure out how we would go about doing that.
Yeah, the doctor in Jurassic Park says, discovery is a violent and dangerous undertaking.
That's right. Yeah, I'm definitely in favor of raping and pillaging Europa and Enceladus for its scientific knowledge. Absolutely.
I can't wait for somebody to clip that little audio tape out.
Flash, Dr. Novello calls for the genocide of life forms.
No, the price of real estate's on the moon, Brian. That's where you want to sell real estate. Oh.
Yeah.
No way, man. All the money's in asteroids. Just wait.
No. You're all wrong. It's
love that game.
Plastics.
Plastics.
Nanoplastics.
Or maybe synthetic organisms, right?
Oh, yeah.
Ooh.
You mean like that sex doll that they made?
Oh, God.
Exactly.
Just like that.
They're only $1,000 each.
Except.
Cherry 2000? Yeah.
It's a deal when you consider how much dating costs these days.
Just $1,000?
Yeah, well, that's the base. That's the base model, Bob.
Doesn't actually have a face.
It doesn't need
comes
one,
with a
right?
That's
the
face upgrade's an extra $2,000.
Bob, that was my segue, Bob, to your.
I know, but they're hijacking. They're hijacking your segue, Steve. You guys know DARPA, right? We've all heard of DARPA, right? Defense Advanced Research Project Agency. That's the mad science wing of the United States Department of Defense.
Love them.
They basically, they are so awesome.
Bob,
they
don't
fund
they run that whole TV show Lost?
That's what I said. I just made that joke.
Did you just say
DARPA initiative?
Yeah. The DARPA, good. DARPA really does, they don't mess with islands. They fund innovative research, whether it's through government labs or private sector, academia, etc. They came up with ARPANET, which was the predecessor of the internet. You may have heard of that. You hear about some new research that DARPA is funding. Either it's really like gee whiz cool stuff, or maybe it's like sometimes it's like bad sci-fi movie crazy, and sometimes it's actually both. So part of their budget for 2011 was released recently, revealing that they've got a new project, $6 million for
really?
A project called
$6 million. What? Dollars.
I know. But actually, this is $6 million specifically for this project called Biodesign. They also have another $20 million for just like generic research into synthetic life, and then another $7 million into some other related. So it's
are they going to use that money to make a man out of it?
Oh man, somebody already made that joke. That was good though, Steve. Okay. Somebody in the comments, are they going to make $6 million man? So Biodesign, what the hell is Biodesign? Well, this is how they describe it in their report. Biodesign is a new intellectual approach to biological functionality. The intrinsic concept is that by using gained knowledge of biological processes in combination with biotechnology and synthetic chemical technology, humans can employ system engineering methods to originate novel beneficial processes. So
I love corporate speak, don't you?
Yeah, right. It seems then that DARPA wants to do research on and ultimately create synthetic organisms to accomplish a host of possible tasks. Now, by synthetic organism, it's kind of a – I guess it can be a little bit ambiguous. They don't mean some sort of gooey super soldier like some people literally – some people I've been reading seem to think that they're going to make this super – you know, literally like a $6 million man type of artificial organism. But I think it's pretty obvious that what they're talking about is bacteria that's been modified genetically to some degree to have some new highly beneficial capabilities. They don't say that specific – you know, exactly that way, but that's pretty much – it's pretty obvious, I think, what they're talking about.
Well, Bob, that doesn't fall too far from nanotechnology then.
When you get down to that level, it's all – you know, they're all little machines in a sense. Oh, yeah, you're right, Jay. But actually, they're not just little machines. I mean, these things they're talking about, at least initially, is basically taking bacteria, living organisms, and kind of – hijacking them. Now we may be closer to this than you guys think, because and we may have even surpassed it in some ways. Scientists have already created artificial chromosomes, ribosomes, and even they've moved entire genomes from one microbe to another. They're really making some interesting advances. Now we can genetically tweak bacteria, but no one's really done it in such a way yet that they give the bacteria new abilities, superpowers or whatever, but it seems pretty inevitable to me that we'll be seeing that relatively soon. Now, there's a lot of these. This document talks about these attributes that these organisms will include, and there some of these attributes are a little bit unusual. Some of them are, let's see, in a genetically encoded kill switch. Should something go wrong, whether it's like a mutation or if they get mad at us, you know, you just kind of flip a switch or whatever.
Yeah. But what if the kill switch mutates?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We are screwed.
We're really the monsters.
Another thing they've got is a self-destruct option that's activated upon nefarious removal of organism. I guess that means that it dies if you try to remove it from underneath your fingernail or whatever its habitat is.
That's like the alien. The patient dies if you take it off his face.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, to get
or
that acid
like
blood spewing out.
The lysine solution from Jurassic Park, right?
Right, yeah. And of course, animals have found a way around that, and it's funny, Steve, because other articles have said that specific thing. And here's this last one here that I want to cover. This one was a bit vague. Let's see if I might need some help actually interpreting what they mean here. They say strategies that would enable a new generation of regenerative cells that could ultimately be programmed to live indefinitely until needed for an injury repair or therapeutic application. So. A lot of different people are interpreting that in different ways. A lot of people are saying that these are going to be killer immortal organisms. They're never going to die. Yeah, I don't interpret it that way. I don't interpret it that way. Let me say what I think, Steve. See if you agree. It seems to me that they're talking about some sort of like a medicine or healing salve that never goes bad. You could take it on a trip to Mars, and 3 years later, it'll still be good and still be able to actually help people if they get injured. I mean, they're talking about therapeutic applications and injury repair. What do you think, Steve?
That's how it struck me too. That's what I was going to
say.
Yeah,
yeah.
It'll keep until you need to close up a wound or something with it. Yeah.
Yeah, because they're doing in the report. They mention a lot about cell death. What is it called? Apoptosis.
Yeah.
Programmed cell death, because cells are programmed to die. You give a cell the right chemical signal, and it'll just say adios. Scusi, milli regretti, and they're dead.
Yeah, without that, you get things like cancer.
Big ghost.
Right, exactly. So that's what I think. All these people are going off on how, oh, they're going to be immortal, and they're going to kill us, all this. They're just really kind of going overboard. But there was one aspect of this paper that struck me. But the quote was this: biodesign eliminates the randomness of natural evolutionary advancement. So a lot of people were jumping on that, saying, oh, evolution isn't random, blah, blah, blah. The Wired article actually had a biology professor, David Fitch, he had a quote. He says, evolution by selection is not a random process at all. It's actually a hugely efficient design algorithm used extensively in computation and engineering. Now, that's fine. That's true, of course. It's not random. Natural selection is not random. But if you look at the whole quote here, I think it's clear what they're talking about. The whole quote is, biodesign eliminates the randomness of natural evolutionary advancement primarily by advanced genetic engineering and molecular biology technologies to produce the intended biological effect. So they're not saying that natural selection is random. They're saying that the cause that natural selection is based on a random mutation, whether it's a cosmic ray that hits a germline cell nucleus or it's a copy error. That's what's random about evolution. It's not natural selection itself, but what natural selection works off of.
Yeah, you can also evolution is unpredictable in that we may be able to say that organisms are going to find solutions to their problems. We don't know which ones they're going to hit upon.
Right.
Whereas you can't say, with our conversation with Simon Conway Morris notwithstanding, about convergent evolution, there's still a lot of, quirkiness in evolution. If you couldn't say, I'm going to create the conditions in which this specific organism with this specific traits will evolve and then have it happen, right? So they're saying this is almost like taking control of the process, so you know what the end product is going
to
be.
Exactly. So what they're proposing is the ability to come up with a biological function first, and then figuring out what the genome would need to look like to accomplish that.
That seems really challenging, though. I mean, that requires
a
level of knowledge of how the genome translates into the proteome, into the organism.
Oh, absolutely.
That we don't have. I mean, that's why it's a lot easier actually just to let evolution do its job.
And see what you get. Yeah, no one's saying this isn't going to be fiendishly complicated. Biotechnology and genetic engineering, the tools are getting cheaper and cheaper and more accessible. And eventually you can have somebody in their basement can whip out a nasty pathogen.
Stop fear-mongering me,
Bob. You got to be prepared for this stuff. You got to be ready for this stuff.
How am I supposed to prepare for this? What, am I going to get a baseball bat and go basement to basement?
That's what I'm doing right now. I'm supporting this research.
Okay. When Mr. Sunnyside comes out with this dark shit, it kind of freaks you out, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I think the broader concept is that as technology has been advancing, not just this type of technology, but many different kinds, it's becoming easier and easier for people without much resources to have more and more power in their hands, right? I mean, individuals can whip up powerful, bombs or explosives, or can
Iran?
Yeah, I mean,
or podcasts.
Right. It's right. It's going to get as 50, 100 years from now. Think about the power that an individual can wield, and if they have nefarious goals, it is pretty scary.
And it could be 20 years from now.
I don't think it's that scary.
In about 5 years, I'm going to be wielding the power of Grayskull
with your cat. What was his name? Cringer.
Wow.
I know you already have the costume.
All right, well, Jay, we have a few items this week which are amazing technology claims or promises from different corporations or groups. Jay, you're going to tell us about the amazing promise of spray-on glass.
Yeah, so I blogged about this last week. The first thing is I tried to vet this better than just information that came from the company, but as it stands today, the only information about this product is from the company that's producing it. So this company in Germany called Nanopool came out with spray-on glass. So they take a liquid or liquefied glass that they can spray on. When it hits the object, they say it's going to be either 15 or 30 molecules thick. It's supposedly flexible. It's breathable. It has an antibacterial quality to it because bacteria can't stick to it and grow on it. So this product, they claim that you only have to clean it with hot water. You wouldn't need to use any chemicals. It can protect against heat, dirt, UV radiation.
The cooties?
And normal.
The heebie-jeebies?
Bacteria. Just normal wear and tear. And, the thing that's really profound about it is that it could go on virtually anything.
Yeah.
You could protect anything.
Babies.
Yeah, think how cool you'd look if you sprayed that on your face.
Right.
You'd have the shiniest face around.
But you could, they say you can't actually see it when it's applied, that it is invisible because of how thin it is. And even though it seems like it wouldn't be, but at that thickness, it would be flexible.
Are there any photos?
There was, but you can't see it.
Go to the Rogues Gallery. They show. I guess it broken where they bent it enough where it would break, and they show the edging of it. But they don't have like a picture of a product with it applied because I guess it would just look like the product normally. Now this product, unlike Bob's new story, my new story, you could buy this product in Germany right now. And it'll be in
the UK.
In the UK, yeah, and this year, this
spring. So I could pick it up.
You got to pick it up.
It's basically, silicon dioxide, right? And it's just really just the technique of applying it in such a micro-thin, or what they call an ultra-thin layering. I guess that's the new bit, because silicon dioxide's been around for a while. So it's interesting. It's certainly an interesting concept.
What do you think quantum has to do with it? Do you think it's quantum in any way?
Well, I'll tell you, I read a bunch of articles on this, and the one thing that – one red flag for me was that a lot of people were saying that it adheres to the surfaces through quantum forces, and that's all they said about it, quantum forces. Well, can you elaborate, please? Nobody elaborated.
Nope.
Except one site, one guy was saying that it's electrostatic forces. So I don't know. Apparently that's how it adheres.
Would you like to know why they're describing it as adhering in a quantum manner?
Go ahead.
That's because that's the exact wording that's used on Nanopool's press release that was released in April 11th, 2009, and which every single article has quoted from directly, including The Telegraph, which has a quote from Neil McClellan, Nanopool's UK project manager, that they say, Neil McClellan told – oh, I'm sorry, The Independent. Told The Independent, and then they have a quote. And that quote is lifted directly from the press release that was published last spring.
Yeah, so what we have here is a corporate press release.
Yeah, they're hyping.
Yeah, what we have is a whole lot of hype built upon one press release and a whole lot of journalists not doing their damn job.
Yeah,
quoting directly. Not only are they quoting directly from a press release, they're quoting from a press release that's 9 months old. And then they're just quoting from one another and passing it around, and then it becomes a big story on the internet.
Big echo chamber,
I would love to pick some up in the UK when it becomes available, but I am highly suspicious that it will ever actually become available here. And in fact, I'm suspicious that it's available anywhere.
Yeah.
Rebecca, it's almost as if you're saying that it's a scam.
I would never say that, though, because I live in a country where the libel laws are horrible.
Are we ridiculous?
I don't have enough money to fight against that.
I would never call it a scam. The point is
– But yes.
The point well made is, yes, it's not vetted yet. We don't know, and you know, just like a million other press releases and things that we've heard companies talk about their products. Mm-hmm. Sure, it could be, and at this point, we have to just assume that it's overblown, the claims or whatever. But these are the kinds of products that that as we advance in nanotechnology, these are the types of things that are going to be produced.
Yeah, absolutely. There's nothing implausible about this, and the applications seem perfectly reasonable. But it is frustrating that as I tried to dig into this too, all I could find was the company's own hype and people speculating about it. You know, and that was it. There was no actual published studies or actual journalism or anything. You know, there's just nothing to go on.
And they do make quite a show about saying about all these studies that have been done. I think one study that they said it was tested for like a year. They put it on seeds, and it actually helped the seed grow because the seed apparently didn't have to defend itself against like a fungus. It could just put all its resources towards growing and all.
Yeah.
But where are these studies? I mean, maybe they can't report on the studies yet, but
they specifically say our research, which implies that this is research that they're funding.
It's in-house.
Yeah,
that's right.
Equals worthless.
Yeah. Can't go
I hear
with
they're
going
to get Philip Morris to do some research on it, too.
And at the end, they're like, it definitely doesn't cause cancer.
Oh, there's already fiberglass in.
I hope
in
it's true.
This story's plausible, but just, you know, all we have to go on
it's
is
a little fishy.
Corporate hype. But the next one's even worse. This one's been making the rounds. A company called Carbon Sciences, Inc., and their plan – they've been around for a couple of years, actually, and they've occasionally come out with press releases about the fabulous things they're going to do. But their plan is to use atmospheric carbon dioxide to capture that carbon and to make stuff out of it. A year ago, they were talking about making something called green carbon, which is calcium carbonate, which they said they could use – would have several uses, but – like agriculture, manufacturing paper, coatings, plastics, but the advantage is that it's using as raw material CO2 in the atmosphere, so it would undo some of the release of greenhouse gases of CO2 from burning coal, for example.
It's a win-win.
So how are they collecting this?
through their proprietary process. That's their technology, right? Is
and that's their explanation?
Well, they go on, they say things like they run it across a filter which uses enzymes to extract the CO2, but they're obviously not going to say exactly how they do it. That's their corporate secret, right? That's their technology.
Right.
But now they put out a press release which is really dubious. Now they're saying that they're going to make gasoline out of the carbon dioxide that they sequester from the smokestacks of a coal factory, or they could make jet fuel or diesel, you know, basically gas. Not impossible. You know, it's certainly not impossible. You can certainly get, you know, carbon dioxide and other stuff and make gasoline out of it if you had the right process. That's not the part that's dubious. The problem is that would be a horrifically energy-intensive process, right? You're essentially reversing the burning of gasoline, taking the end products and putting it back together to gasoline. That has to take more energy than you would get out of the resulting gasoline, right? That's a pesky thermodynamics again. You can't.
What would the byproduct be? And all, a whole bunch of other questions.
It can't even be. Even if the process itself doesn't produce anything wasteful, and you just get gasoline, then you burn the gasoline back into its products again, and it just completely closes the loop. You have to lose energy each step of the way. So, what they were actually talking about was, well, you know, you could build a nuclear power plant and dedicate the energy from that power plant to making the gasoline from atmospheric CO2, which you may even be collecting from a coal-burning power plant. That would be the most ridiculous thing in the world to do, because, you know, you could just offset the energy production of the coal plants with the nuclear power plant in the first place, and that would be far more efficient, energy efficient, than making gasoline out of the CO2 and then burning that for energy. Right,
because to be fair, the most ridiculous thing you could do would be to gather up leprechauns and burn those for energy.
Right,
just to be fair,
right, but
slightly less ridiculous.
But the press release, and actually, I mean, again, as you say, the news stories, which are largely cribbed from the press releases, don't even mention that fact. They just make it seem like, how amazing is it that they're going to be able to make gasoline from atmospheric CO2.
Steve,
yeah.
do we know if they are a competitor in Richard Branson's XPRIZE for the is that what they're trying to do here?
I didn't see any mention of that, but you know what? The carbon sequestration industry is a burgeoning multi-billion-dollar industry. I suspect that they're trying to capitalize on that. Also, if you go to their website, they certainly are looking for investors and, you know, trying to sell themselves as a company. So I also suspect this is all about promoting themselves as a company and trying to get in on, you know, the money that governments will be spending to address the concerns about carbon and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So I think they're just being opportunists. And it certainly sounds sexy, you know, to make gasoline out of, but it just makes absolutely no sense from a thermodynamic energy point of view.
I think we have different definitions of the word sexy.
Sexy from a technological point of view.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, I mean, it all depends on what the product is. I mean, making clothing consumes more energy than it produces. You know, making movies consumes more energy than it produces.
Yeah, but they're making energy. That's the point. If you're making energy and the process consumes more energy than it produces,
what's the point?
That wouldn't work.
Yeah. So that's my point. Now, their original thing that they were saying a year ago, we're going to make paper and plastics and glass out of it. Fine, do that. I mean, that makes sense. You have you're taking the carbon, you're spending energy to manufacture a physical product, which you're then going to use in manufacturing.
Right.
That makes more sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But this whole ridiculous thing. It reminds me a lot of like the car adapters that split water into hydrogen,
yeah,
and oxygen,
right.
And then burn the hydrogen with the oxygen to make
it.
Energy. That's always a scam. Whenever you have this two-step process that, you know, uses energy to make energy, it's always a waste. So that part of this whole thing is just ridiculous. Although the older concept that they were selling actually can make sense, and we may in fact be doing right. that at some point. Rather than just dumping the carbon down into the ground to get rid of it, we might as well make stuff out of it if it's cost effective.
Steve, you know what I thought of when I heard this? I remember reading years ago. I didn't find out exactly where I read this. I think it might have been Eric Drexler's Engines of Creation, the first book that kind of really started the whole nanotechnology craze. And he said that there's so much carbon in the atmosphere that you could literally have, you know, 10 billion people live in the lap of luxury for years and years and years if you could take all that carbon and use it for, you know, for building structures and all the different things that you could make out of carbon. And I mean, and there's nothing, you know, physics says that there's nothing wrong with that. And you're right. I think we will eventually, one way or the other, we'd be able to pull the carbon out of the atmosphere.
Yeah, if you have the energy to do it. So just to give you an example, in 2005, there were 25 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide released into the atmosphere.
Oh, man. That's one year?
That's a lot of raw material. I mean, if you can effectively, efficiently get access to it. So that much of it makes sense. Well, let's lighten it up a little bit. Rebecca, you're going to tell us about an interesting story.
I don't know that I would consider this lightening it up, though.
Well,
I mean, just a warning to our listeners that this story does involve a 15-year-old girl being stabbed and impregnated.
Well, there is that.
So, not exactly lighter fare as it's normally known, but it is interesting. There was a study published, and it's making the rounds online, I think because there's a great blog, NCBI, ROFL, and they dig up funny peer-reviewed studies that they find in journals and post them. And so they posted one that's actually from 1988 in Lesotho, where the title of the paper is Oral Conception, Impregnation via the Proximal Gastrointestinal Tract in a Patient with an Aplastic Distal Vagina, Case Report. And basically what happened, according to this this paper, and it was just one small article, is that a 15-year-old girl working at a local bar, I told you it wasn't going to be a nice story, was with her new boyfriend giving him oral pleasure, trying to be as adult as I can.
Pouring him a beer is what you mean.
Yes. when
they were talking about it?
When her ex-boyfriend came upon them. Wait, no.
Wait.
When her ex-boyfriend discovered them in the middle of the act.
He poured them each a beer as well.
Yes. Happy ending. Story done. No. So he flew into a rage, pulled a knife, and all three parties ended up with stab wounds and went to the hospital. The girl had some lacerations on her left hand and a single stab wound in the upper abdomen, and that had formed actually two holes in her stomach because it went straight through. So the doctors performed some surgery on her, and it went very well. They noted that her stomach was empty at the time, and then they stitched her up, or they repaired her abdominal wall, and then they cleaned out her insides basically with saline before they closed her up, and then they sent her home after 10 days. She was fine. So fast forward to precisely 278 days later, the patient came back to the hospital complaining of acute complaining of acute abdominal pain. And what they found was that she was pregnant. So you might be thinking, well, this is, you know, she probably got pregnant after the incident or before. Well, the thing is that she doesn't actually have a vagina. She is one of, I think it's one in 5,000 girls is born without a vagina, there's a shallow skin dimple, is what they called it, beneath her urethra. And but nothing that, you know, you could possibly impregnate someone through. And what the...
That was quite the conundrum.
Yeah. So the conclusion that the doctors came to was
the
that...
The star in the east?
Right. Yeah, that it must have been Jesus. No. What they figured was that she had swallowed the semen of her boyfriend, and when they were flushing out her abdomen, somehow it pushed the semen from her stomach into her womb.
Well, it's mommy's tummy, so it was already in the right place, right?
Isn't that mommy's tummy?
Actually, I'll come back to that.
Well, the fallopian tubes are open to the abdominal cavity.
So yeah,
really?
That's the
why
they are
because evolution is a messy
why?
Process.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have your ovaries. Just to quickly give you the anatomy here, the fallopian tubes are like next to the ovaries, but it's open to the peritoneum, the cavity in there. It is open.
Right. The thing that makes it odder is the idea that if she doesn't have a vagina, then she must have been, this must have been the first time that she was ovulating, or one of the first times she was ovulating, because otherwise, when you ovulate, if you don't have a vagina, there's nothing to flush out the old eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And so it would build up inside of her, and it wouldn't be conducive to sperm at all. So, I mean, it's almost fair to call this one a miracle, because if this happened as reported,
almost.
Then it's possible. It's highly improbable. But to support the story, the doctor who is reporting it has contributed on several other papers and is apparently still alive and working. It's certainly not presented as any kind of prank. But, you know, what goes against it is, you know, the complete implausibility of this actually, all of these things happening in order to create a baby.
It's so incredibly implausible.
Right.
Or just improbable. I should say improbable.
Improbable, yeah.
Right.
And there's also, I mean, this bears quite a close resemblance to a common urban legend, which is that there was a man who was, I think the most common version is that it was, or the, at least the first version, I should say, was during a war. I think it was maybe the Civil War, where a soldier was shot through the testicles and the slug ended up in a woman's uterus and managed to carry sperm into the woman and impregnate her. This was a hoax that was put into a newspaper, but then was published in The Lancet, actually. And they acknowledged that it was tongue-in-cheek. But, just the mere fact that it's there, and people sometimes don't have properly working irony detectors, it got re-reported as fact. So is it possible that a prominent journal, which this was published in a decent journal, not just some, you know.
Yeah, I
rag.
Checked it out. It's there. It's listed as it's in the peer reviewed literature.
So is it possible that, you know, such a hoax of some sort was published in a legitimate journal? Yes, totally. I mean, look, Wakefield did it. so zing. But I don't think I could comment one way or the other whether or not it's true. But, those are the facts as I know them. It's possible. It's not very plausible or probable.
Probable.
But, it could happen. So, I should say as a coda, to come back around to female anatomy, I found the saddest part of the entire thing was reading the comments underneath of NCVIRFL. Not one, but two different commenters wrote, "How did she pee?"
Right.
How did she pee? Which, you know, kudos to them for asking the question, because that's how we learn.
Yeah.
But
it's a fair question.
If someone is old enough to read through that entire article in order to understand that this girl did not have a particular part of her anatomy, but not be smart or not be educated enough to realize that there are two different holes there. Three, in fact, if you really look. That's disturbing that people are out there and know so little about anatomy. So
yeah, I mean, I think they're counting the vagina as the whole thing.
I think that there are an alarming number of people out there who believe that the vagina is one hole that is used for feces and sex and urinating, which is, yeah, it's a little sad. So please, people, come on. Sex ed, health, education.
Premarital sex, whatever it takes.
Whatever it takes. Healthy exploration.
When I wrote my blog about the spray-on glass, I didn't think that it could also be used as a contraceptive, because if she sprayed it on her stomach, that knife would have just ching right off.
That's
it wouldn't
true.
Have penetrated the skin.
That's true.
Do you
think that the glass would work on a penis as kind of an instant condom sort of thing?
That would be awesome, because you couldn't see it or feel it.
Yeah. It'd be pretty good.
Interesting.
Easy cleanup, too.
I hate to be around when it breaks, though.
Yeah, right?
Ouch. Good point.
It's okay. I spray it on protection, baby. It's good.
Yeah, right. Like any girl would believe that. Or guy.
So this is definitely one of those stories where I was not only skeptical, but almost sure that it was an urban legend when I first heard it. Because it's too perfect. You know, she couldn't have gotten impregnated because she didn't have a vagina. Therefore, we knew it had to be this improbable thing with the knife
right.
and everything.
Oh, and, you know, I'm sorry, I completely forgot to mention that one of the other factors that makes this highly improbable is the fact that, you know, sperm can't survive very long in an environment with low pH. But the study acknowledges that and says that, or I shouldn't say study, the paper acknowledges that and points out that saliva has a high pH and that the fact that she had nothing else in her stomach, they say a starved person, so maybe she was literally starving. Obviously, she wasn't in the best of conditions, doesn't produce acid under normal circumstances, and therefore that her stomach might have actually been quite conducive to sperm.
Well, it's not only that, but the ejaculate does have a lot of protective fluids there, you know, for the sperm, and that may have kept them viable long enough for the contents to spill out of her stomach and into her abdomen, where they would be away from the stomach acids, the concentrated stomach acids.
Right.
And then the lavage, you know, the taking the saline and rinsing down the abdomen helped the sperm along on its journey down into the lower abdomen, where it got access to the fallopian tubes. So,
I think that might be the only case ever where good birth control would consist of just eating a donut.
Right.
Or, you know, not getting stabbed. Just don't get stabbed.
Yeah, that too.
Wonder if the Mythbusters will take this one on.
Well, Evan, can you please enlighten us as to the nature of last week's Who's That Noisy?
Yes, I should play it for everyone as a reminder, but this week, the Who's That Noisy is brought to you by Host Papa. For those of you who want your website to be brought down for absolutely no good reason, buy an account at Host Papa.
You want to go there? So, yes. Neurologica was down for the Rogues Gallery. We're down for 3 days because the Nest site, where both those blogs are on, was hosted by Host Papa, who says unlimited bandwidth. What they don't tell you is that they limit the number of simultaneous connections that you can have.
That's how they get you.
Neurologica was mentioned in the LA Times on Saturday, and as was Skeptic and a lot of other skeptical blogs. It was a very good article that I'm assuming that gave me a pulse of people checking out Neurologica. And Host Papa responded by shutting us down.
And
permanently.
Permanently. Making it look like you hadn't paid your bills.
Yeah.
I wrote back to the automatic email that gets generated, and I wrote this really nice email, explained to them what happened. It was a big, you know, it was a big deal for us to get mentioned in this newspaper, blah, blah, blah. We get back an email, and I said, could you please just turn us back on for a couple of days, and I'll move the site to another host that can accommodate a larger, you know, larger bandwidth and all that, right? The guy writes, I'm sorry, I can't do that. You're shut down permanently.
Yep.
That's it. You're done.
Goodbye. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's unreal.
And
so that's HostPop of listeners, and take note of that for any of you who have some business with HostPop.
Yeah, they're
please.
Like, what are you going to do? Tell 70,000 people this podcast?
Yeah. No. I'd like to see that happen.
Uh-huh. Oh, talk about all terrible. Right. So they punished us for having a good day by shutting us down and making it a horrible day. Thank you.
It's unbelievable. Anyway, yes.
Thanks for reminding me of that. And tell us about Who's That Noisy.
Here it is from last week. Not quite. No, not lasers in a bad movie or a good movie for that matter. But no, that was the sound of cracking ice sheets, if you can believe it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Dispersion of sound waves in ice sheets.
Never would have thought of that.
Was that slowed down, Evan?
No, well, I think that was actual
time.
Time? Yeah.
It was real time? Okay.
I would have thought it would have been like maybe something in the polls or something huge, but like
a surprising number of people got this correct. You know, a bunch of people who are like, you know, spend all their leisure time listening to podcasts and ice fishing, apparently. They sent us pictures of the fish they caught when they were on the ice, when they heard it, and a whole bunch, you know, it was interesting.
It's apparently a common thing for a lot of audio guys to do. I have some friends who are into kind of weird experimental music noise things, and you can freeze a microphone and then record the sound as it, like in a block of ice, and then just record the sound of the ice block melting, and it's really cool. So
wow!
And our friend Evil Eye from the message boards was the first one to guess it correctly.
Evil Eye, are we going to have to? Okay, here's the thing. Let's give Evil Eye a handicap because this is like not the first time he's won, right?
Well, he admits he's a geek and he's into a lot of obscure kind of sciencey things.
I think Evil Eye is awesome. Okay, but I think Evil Eye will be up for this if we give him. I'd say, what do you say, like a 2-hour handicap after Steve posts the podcast.
He's got to wait 2 hours before he could post the solution.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right. That sounds like a good idea.
I think he'll be okay with that. It's sporty. So.
It's a badge of honor. He's won the prize of getting a lot of these correct. So now he gets
he gets the host papa treatment. He gets shut down.
he's driving from the tees that's really far back. That's because he's a professional.
Yeah, I was going to say it's like when Tiger
that's
Woods
a golf
has
term.
You know. Bat the ball.
Yes. score the touchdown in the ninth inning.
All
that's right.
Right.
Yeah.
Evan, what do you have for us this week?
And on to this week's Who's That Noisy? Let's see if you can figure this out.
That's exploding
slinky,
crickets.
Slinky.
Slinky.
Crickets in the LHC. Taking a ride in the Large Hadron Collider. No, give it a guess. That's a tough one, I admit. There's a lot of possibilities, so give it your best guess.
Good luck, everyone. I like the sounds better than the people talking because you can't Google.
Well, you can't always Google the name. But I know what you're saying. So
yeah. All right. We're going to do one email. This is kind of a name that logical fallacy, but it's really a question about a logical fallacy. It's not a statement itself. This one comes from Dave Hampson from Pullman, who's not to be confused with Dave Pullman from Hampson. And he writes...
What kind of joke was that? Oh. It was awful.
It was funny when I said it in my head before the show.
It's called a switcheroo, Rebecca.
Right, right.
Okay, go on.
And David Hampson... Right.
From where?
I love the podcast and look forward to it each week. However, I do listen to other skeptical podcasts. I wonder which one he's talking about there. One day, the hosts were picking apart an argument and making reference to all the false analogies therein. Several of them proffered their own analogies. Now, I agreed with the skeptics, but several days later, it dawned on me that someone with a different perspective could potentially accuse the skeptics of creating false analogies. This got me to thinking. Much of everyday language is analogy. Some would say all language is just a series of analogies. So how can we create analogies that can be demonstrably false from multiple perspectives? Under what conditions can we extend an argument to its logical conclusion? Analogies are a wonderful tool for explaining complex issues in a way familiar to the listener, but I want to be able to do this right. Do you rogues have any thoughts on this? Should we try to avoid making analogies at all? I think this would make a good topic for discussion. Thanks for your consideration. So I agree. This is a really good topic for consideration. Analogies are extremely useful. I certainly wouldn't say don't, you know, avoid making analogies. I just think they have to be done carefully. What I find when I use an analogy in making an argument is that often the people I'm arguing against will attempt to shoot down the analogy by saying that the two things that I'm comparing are not analogous in every way, or they're specifically not analogous in a way that I wasn't comparing them in the first place. You know what I mean?
Yeah, when you're making an analogy, you're comparing specific properties of two things. You're not comparing the two things in all their properties.
Right.
So it's easy to zoom in on the few properties that don't match up, but it's important to refocus the conversation on the ones that do.
Yeah, so it's kind of it's not a false analogy. It's a false criticism of an analogy. Whereas a false analogy is when you're trying to make an analogy between two properties of two things that are in fact not analogous. I don't know of any formula to try to really sort that out. It really is a judgment. You have to take each case on its own merits and say, you know, is this a fruitful analogy that's actually helping to deepen our understanding of the point that's being made, or is it throwing us off in a wrong direction, or what? So,
well, I think that that's the point, though, of looking at the properties. So when someone makes an analogy, you know, A is like B, you need to look closely at both things and consider their differences. And if any of the differences affect the actual property that you're discussing, then that's a false analogy.
Right. So I can give you a really inflammatory example from a recent episode of the SGU. It's like saying that global warming denial is like Holocaust denial.
Yeah.
Yes, they're analogous in some of the types of arguments that are being used by the extremist of both those points. But then, you know, a lot of people criticize that analogy by saying, so you're saying that, you know, global warming skeptics are like Nazis, you know. It's like, well, no. It wasn't a comparison that was being drawn in that way. It was purely the analogy purely related to some of the types of arguments that they make, or the way they dismiss the scientific consensus. But it doesn't mean that you are necessarily implying an analogy in any other way. But that's often the difficulty that we run into.
You know, you can also answer a false analogy charge with making another finding out something wrong with the analogy. For example, if I went out and beat someone up, you could say, oh, that was just like when Shane Stant beat up Nancy Kerrigan with the pipe before the Olympics. And I could say, I could defend myself against that by saying, I'm nowhere near as fat as Shane Stant.
Right. Yeah, it's a false analogy. It's really a non sequitur,
yeah,
that you're using to counter a legitimate analogy.
Non sequitur.
Here's one that actually I've been given to me by a UFO proponent who asked me, well, have you ever seen in person the Great Wall of China?
Then how
do you know it's really there? By the same token, I've never seen a UFO, but I can still know that they exist. So there's a false analogy there, because, you know, the Great Wall of China has loads of evidence to support its actual existence. I don't need to have personally been there and seen it. But, you know, the UFOs do not have a similar level of evidence. And in fact, there are other more likely interpretations of UFOs being alien spacecraft. There really isn't any other interpretation of the evidence for the Great Wall of China, right? So it really wasn't analogous in any important way to support the point that he was trying to make, that if you believe in the Great Wall of China, you should believe that we're being visited by aliens.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready?
Mm-hmm.
Standing boss.
Okay. Item number one, a new study links drinking two or more cans of soda per week to an increased risk of brain tumors. Item number two, new research finds that underdogs do not work harder. In fact, people try harder when competing against a lower-ranked rather than a higher-ranked opponent. And item number three, scientists recently described a sea slug that makes its own chlorophyll and has chloroplasts that it uses to make energy from sunlight like a plant, the only multicellular animal known to do so.
Oh, good for him.
Wow.
Brian, as our guest this week, why don't you go first?
Oh, boy. I was hoping I could go after Jay because, to me, that's kind of like Monty Hall opening the door to reveal the goat.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Son of a bitch.
Bazinga.
A new study links drinking two or more cans of soda per week to an increased risk of brain cancer. Well, I drink about 20 or more cans of soda per week, so I hope that's not true. That's I could go either way on that one. Underdogs do not work harder. People try harder when competing against a lower-ranked rather than a higher-ranked opponent. That seems counterintuitive to me. But we don't know what kind of research that was, do we? Do we get any hints like that?
Usually not, unless something really needs to be clarified.
Okay. You can cleverly pry something out of Steve.
A scientist have recently described a sea slug that makes its own chlorophyll and has chloroplasts that it uses to make energy from sunlight like a plant. Only multicellular animal known to use chlorophyll to make energy from sunlight. I'm surprised actually that there's not more than one, because that to me does not seem too terribly improbable.
There's poison ivy from Batman.
that's another one. So
that's two.
So yeah,
so maybe that's the fiction.
That's got to be the fiction. I'm going to go with the two or more cans of soda per week
as the fiction,
only because I hope that that's not true, because otherwise I'm in big trouble.
Okay, Bob.
I'm second, huh?
Yeah.
all right,
Bob, you are so observant.
Seems to be so.
Two or more cans of soda per week, brain tumors. You know, that's got to be true, because I just know soda is poison. I knew it all. I knew it all along.
Logical fallacy.
Processed food.
The second one,
natural.
I'll skip to a sea slug making chlorophyll. That's awesome. That would be so cool. Our mitochondria come from bacteria. Maybe this sea slug kind of somehow incorporated this into its body, but it'd have to be in the germline. Wow. All right, I don't know about that one. But the second one doesn't look – the underdog one doesn't look too good to me either. Something doesn't make sense to me, that's how it would be. I mean, why would you try harder when going against a lower-ranked person? It just doesn't make sense. I just see you get lazy. Oh, he's lower-ranked. I'll take it easy. But maybe Steve wants us to think that. I'm going to say that the underdog is fiction.
Okay. Evan?
Two or more cans of soda per week, an increased risk of brain tumors. That's not a lot of soda, and it's a big, effect. It also doesn't say, there's diet soda and there's sugary soda. So I don't know about that one.
There's soda water.
There is, isn't there?
There's also soda pop.
And baking soda.
Soda pop.
Soda jerks.
Soda bread.
Soda light.
Sammy soda. No.
There's soda. These guys sound like idiots.
There's Kaiser soda.
Uh-huh. All right, that's helping me. Good, I got all that. Moving on. Underdogs not working harder. Opponents. Is this like a sports analogy? I'm trying to see what it's. You're very vague on the context here, Steve. The last one is the sea slug, and that one strikes me as the most plausible, I think, of these three. So, given my choices here, I'm going to say, I'm sorry, Brian, I think I have to say that the two or more cans of soda per week is going to wind up being the science here, and I'm going to say the underdogs one is the fiction.
Okay.
Hope I'm wrong, though.
Okay, Jay.
Okay, a new study links drinking two or more cans of soda a week increased risk of brain tumors. My God. Right out of the gate, how can that possibly be true? Everybody would have brain cancer.
Mr. Statistics.
I'm with Brian. My gut's telling me that can't be true, because how can it be? I drink so much soda.
Can I change my vote?
I'm going to go with Brian and say that drinking two cans of soda a week or more gives you a higher risk of brain cancer.
Sorry, okay, Brian. Rebecca.
Ooh.
Okay. I think I like the idea of sea slugs making their own chlorophyll. I have no biological information to back that up, but I like it. I think it's cute. I think that there's a very good explanation for why underdogs might not work harder. I think that that's science. I think that soda can be very dangerous to your health, but I do not think that it causes an increased risk of brain tumors. So I think that is fiction.
All righty. So you all agree that scientists recently described a sea slug that makes its own chlorophyll and has chloroplasts that it uses to make energy from sunlight like a plant, the only multicellular animal known to do so. See. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Yay, of course. Sea slugs.
Right.
Steve, that's weeks old, dude.
Oh, yeah, gee, dude. Bob. Harsh.
I know, but I couldn't find anything else, and we hadn't used it. None of you guys talked about that. The thing that's really surprising about this is the chloroplasts.
Yes.
This is an animal with chloroplasts. That's not supposed to happen. Chloroplasts evolved in the plant line. This is one of those things that we're not supposed to see.
So they retained it from the primordial soup from
No.
Or is it a crocoduck?
No. Yeah, it's just some kind of evolutionary impossibility. What they figure happened is now this particular sea slug who actually lives in New England and Canada, Alicia chlorotica, and
ooh,
it eats algae.
Sounds sexy.
Yeah, chlorotica, and it eats algae, and it actually gets the chlorophyll genes from the algae and incorporates it into its own DNA and then makes its own chlorophyll, and it can even pass those on to its offspring. However, it cannot make chloroplasts. It has to eat the chloroplasts from the algae, but then it does incorporate those chloroplasts and it uses the chlorophyll, and they can live off of sunlight just like a plant. And they've been doing that. They've had these slugs in a tank, and as long as they give it light 12 hours a day, it survives without any food.
I used to write chlorotica fan fiction.
Is that right? So that's the one that would have got me, honestly, if I hadn't seen the news item and I read that. The chloroplast, very, very strange.
Billy the Sponge moved slowly towards Susie the Sponge.
So, Steve, is this one of those times that being dumb helps?
Yes, it helped quite a bit. All right, we'll go backwards. We'll go to number two. New research finds that underdogs do not work harder. In fact, people try harder when competing against a lower-ranked rather than higher-ranked opponent.
Fiction.
Bob and Evan think that one is the fiction.
Yeah.
And that one is science.
Yeah.
Yeah.
High five, guys.
You guys are idiots.
Undefeated.
Now, that is a little counterintuitive because the conventional wisdom is that the underdogs, the guy in the number two spot, is going to try really hard to get into the number one spot. But actually, when you think about it, this makes sense. Because if you're in the number two spot and you lose to the guy in the number one spot, nothing changes. But if you're in the number one spot, or if you're in any situation, you lose to somebody that's lower ranked than you, that is the worst case scenario for your own prestige and station, right? So
what was the context?
This was – well, they did studies where they took students and they gave them tasks that should not have – that were not that difficult, but how quickly you could do them depended on your effort. So they tried to give an as effort-dependent a task as possible rather than a – skill or talent, based task, right? So, like crossing out all the vowels in a random string of letters. And then they set it up so that they believed that they were competing against other schools to see who would do better. And the students that thought that they were competing against better schools, like obviously higher ranked schools, like not, it's not any question, did worse than those who thought they were competing against obviously lower-ranked schools by about 30%, so a significant effect.
Wow.
Yeah, their interpretation was, well, that, that it makes sense in that, you will fight against the critical blow to your prestige or your ranking by losing to somebody who you should beat, who's actually lower-ranked than you.
And, of course, this explains how they got to become underdogs in the first place, by being slackers.
Right. Right. There, I mean, there is that, but I mean, the way this study was designed, it controlled for that. It really made it seem like it was effort, you know? So all of this means that a new study links drinking two or more cans of soda per week to an increased risk of brain tumors is complete fiction. Because drinking two or more cans of soda was linked to an increased risk of?
Cancer.
What kind of cancer?
Like colon cancer or something?
Pancreatic.
Pancreatic.
Oh, that's what I read.
Yeah,
God damn it.
Right.
I'm screwed.
John,
I'm bastard. You bastard. No.
Now, Steve, did it say between 2 and 20 cans of soda, but you're okay, more than 20?
Yeah, if you go beyond it. It just said more than 2, which is I thought was not that much. That surprised me. This is a prospective 14-year study. Now, they didn't distinguish between diet and regular soda.
They need to.
But
so what is it about soda that does it, Steve?
It's the sugar.
But there's no sugar in diet.
There you go.
Yes, hang on. They didn't distinguish between diet, but they said the cohort that they were looking at drinks overwhelmingly sweetened or sugared soda, not diet, especially as they started it 14 years ago. So they think that even though they didn't track it, probably we're talking about mainly sugared soda. So that's a hole in the study. They should have absolutely tracked that. But if you take the assumption that it probably was a lot of sugared soda, the thinking is that pulsing the pancreas with sugar. Now, pancreas is the organ that makes insulin, which is what would have to deal with a bolus of sugar, and therefore it stresses out the pancreas in a certain way that over years increases the risk of pancreatic cancer. That would mean, of course, that diet sodas would be fine, right? Because you don't get any pulse of sugar. I thought I might catch some people on the – because there is the concern that was raised by really, again, this sort of dedicated group of ideologues for whatever reason think that aspartame is like a deadly poison and that there's a big conspiracy, you know, for the FDA and industry to hide.
God, they are
and,
rabid.
They think that because of one study on rats, right?
Yeah, that's part of the lore.
Rats way too much aspartame.
Yeah, I don't know what came first, that study or the anti-aspartame militia. But one of their claims is that aspartame causes brain tumors. However, that's been studied, and aspartame does not increase your risk of brain tumors. So anyway, I thought I might get somebody on that connection. But this is about the sugar causing pancreatic cancer. So good job, Brian. You're 100% for science or fiction.
That's unprecedented in history,
right.
I think.
And Rebecca and Jay did a good job as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, Bob and Evan, sucked eggs. Yeah.
Right.
Tanked.
Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
Yes, I do. Brian, would you like to say the author's name?
I can say it. I can say. Oh, actually, I don't need to. Here's a visitor just came into my room. Crikey! This is Richard Saunders from Australia. Today's quote comes from Thomas Paine.
That's pretty good.
And that quote is.
Wasn't that good?
It is error only, and not truth, that shrinks from inquiry.
Richard Saunders.
Oh, that's awesome.
Richard's going to be so pleased.
Thomas Paine.
Thomas Paine. Good man.
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy. Tom, that's
Steve,
a good quote.
Thomas Paine. Who is he?
He's some American guy who wrote some common sense pamphlet.
Wrote common sense, yes, pamphlet.
Listen to this. It's funny that you say that because he born in 1737, died in 1809. Thomas Paine was an author, a pamphleteer.
Pamphleteer. It's bigger than
a radical,
yeah.
An inventor, an intellectual, and a revolutionary.
Jay, pamphlets were the blogs of the day.
If you were to extrapolate the number of issues or copies of Common Sense that were published back in 1776, that would equal about 20 million books today.
You know, every single day, the paper boy would bring the Paine.
Right. And wasn't his son a major in the army in the clinic?
Major Paine, yeah. I promised that I would give a shout out to the Double Features Show podcast at doublefeaturesshow.com. I was on there recently talking about The Secret.
And I was asked to give a shout out to the Canberra Skeptics in the Pub on Sunday, 4 p.m., February 21st, at King O'Malley's Irish Pub in the city center. They're going to have their first event. Brian, fun having you join us on the show.
Thanks, yeah. Brian.
Great to be here. It was a real blast.
Well, thanks again, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Doctor.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.